Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore, and my guest this morning is Lloyd Snook. We're going to talk about some constitutional issues this morning with regard to the alt-right meeting which is coming up next weekend. Lloyd Snook grew up in Charlottesville, graduating from Lane High School in 1970. He then went on to Stanford University and graduated in 1974 with an AB in economics. He worked as an investment analyst for 2 years before going on to the University of Michigan School of Law. While at Michigan, he was a member of the Phi Delta Phi, a finalist in moot court competition, and administrative editor of the first volume of the Michigan Yearbook of International Legal Studies, 1978 to 79. He concentrated his studies in criminal and constitutional law and graduated cum laude in 1979. He and Sheila Hoy were married the day after they graduated from the University of Michigan School of Law. Today, he is with the firm Snook and Hoy. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
We're here to talk about the events that are coming up next weekend. For those people who haven't been following it that closely, what's going to happen next weekend?
Well, next weekend, a group that is, it's sort of an ad hoc collection of people who call themselves the alt-right. Some people would say that alt-right is a modern, sanitized way of saying neo-Nazi. Certainly, they are a group that is brought together by a couple of themes. One, the dominant theme is that the notion is that the United States right now is going through a period of decline, and particularly a decline of white power. And therefore, there are certain things that the United States ought to be doing in terms of banning immigration and, you know, all of the political stuff, that some of which Donald Trump has espoused, not all of it, certainly. And so when Trump was elected in last year, the alt-right folks felt newly energized. And so they've been out there. One of the people who's coming is a fellow named Richard Spencer, who's on video around the time of the inauguration doing the Nazi salute, saying, Hail Trump, hail victory, all that kind of stuff. They're consciously adopting a lot of old Nazi themes and trying to put a new, fresher spin on it so as not to seem quite so odious, but it's still the same basic themes. I mean, one of the mottos that were things that was being chanted, there was a May 13th, I believe it was, torchlight rally in what was then called Lee Park, now Emancipation Park. And for those who remember their history, the notion of a bunch of Nazis running around with torches evokes images of Nuremberg and some very ominous rallies back in the 1930s. And so when they're gathering with torches and saying Nazi slogan, and blood and soil, I think, is one of them that was a slogan of the Nazis in the 1930s, it's concerning. It's concerning to a lot of people. And in particular, now that they have kind of coalesced around the issue of moving the statue of Robert E. Lee from Emancipation Park, Jason Kessler, our homegrown alt-righter, apparently has put together this rally called Unite the Right, and invited a bunch of people who have some national credentials in the alt-right movement, including Richard Spencer, to come and have this rally on August 12th, this coming Saturday. They've reserved Emancipation Park from 12 to 5. I don't know exactly what their plan is and when what is going to happen, but that is what people, what the city has been organizing in response to, and that means a couple of things. It means, first of all, the city government has to decide how it's going to handle this, because sometimes alt-right rallies like this have turned violent. And so the police presence has to get figured out, and the police response has to get figured out. And then the you know, Charlottesville is a community that I would say 95% of the people in Charlottesville don't like what the alt-right movement is doing. As we saw on July 8th, a lot of those folks are going to be willing to come out to protest, to march, to be a counter-presence. And so those folks are trying to decide what their response ought to be. And I think it's fair to say that there are an awful lot of people who are trying to plan without enough facts. And we don't, you know, nobody's entirely sure what's going to happen and who's going to do what. And so I think there's going to be, there could be some chaos on Saturday.
And how would you characterize next week's rally as compared to the Klan rally in July? Can we expect more or less the same sort of thing, or will it have a different feel, do you think?
Be very different. The Klan rally in July was really, I mean, more than anything else, it was a costume party. You know, about 40 Klansmen showed up in various forms of their regalia. Some of them didn't have any regalia on at all, and they pranced around for a while, and somebody tried to give a speech through a bullhorn, but nobody could hear a word he was saying. The police helicopter overhead was so loud that even if you could hear over the drums and the other sounds coming from the anti-Klan protesters, you couldn't hear a word the guy was saying. And they held up some very, you know, ugly signs, and particularly anti-Jewish signs. It was really, I thought there was a greater emphasis, you know, anti-Semitism than anti-black in what they were saying. So they were there for about a half an hour, and then they marched away and were escorted out by the police. There are about 40 of them. Jason Kessler has asked for a permit for 400 to be in Emancipation Park, but has been bragging on various the alt-right sites and the neo-Nazi sites that he's expecting thousands to come. So whatever it is, it's going to be substantially larger than 40. The other thing to recognize is that the Klan, at this point, when the Klan does a public rally like they did, they have it pretty well scripted. They know exactly what they can and cannot do. They know exactly what they want to do, which is simply to get publicity for themselves. Whereas the alt-right rallies, I mean, the one that concerns me most is that they, Kessler and others have talked about turning this into another example of Berkeley. Now, what Berkeley means to the alt-right folks is that there's a series of demonstrations in March and April of this year in Berkeley, California, growing out of the question of whether Ann Coulter and Milo, I can't remember what his last name is, another alt-right favorite, could come speak on the Berkeley campus. And the alt-right folks mobilized in support of their coming, and some anti-fascist people, they would call themselves, and mobilized on the other side. And there were open fighting in the streets, and people got hurt and people got arrested. And so Kessler and company are talking about this is going to be another Berkeley. And to us who have looked at these kinds of things, that means that they're threatening actual violence in the streets.
We're going to come back and talk a lot more about the upcoming alt-right rally, but I'd like to take a small diversion here to talk about your firm.
Sure.
Snook and Hoy.
Yes.
And tell me, how long have you been doing this? It's got your name on it, so I guess you're probably pretty important there.
Well, I've been practicing law in Charlottesville for 38 years. As you noted, I grew up here in town, and so I have, you know, a longstanding history here. Sheila and I came back in 1979. She worked for about 10 years, first for the National Legal Research Group, and then she was with the city attorney's office for about 8 years, and then she joined me in practice in 1989. And so we have been the firm of Snook and Hoy since 1989.
And what's the main sort of thrust of the kind of law that you practice there?
Litigation of most sorts. There are a few things we don't do. We don't do bankruptcy. We don't do tax. But we'll do a lot of criminal law, juvenile court, domestic relations, civil litigation, I do personal injury cases. If somebody gets in a boundary line dispute with their neighbor and they want to fight that out in court, there I am, that kind of thing.
And how did you gravitate toward constitutional issues?
Well, I grew up in the 60s, and at a time when civil rights and the constitutional revolution that was sparked by the Warren Court, that was part of why I wanted to be a lawyer. And so that was what interested me. And then in law school, not only taking the standard constitutional law classes, but in seminar in First Amendment case law in particular got me particularly interested in it. I was more interested in representing people than in sort of going into like ACLU stuff per se. I mean, rather than going and working for the ACLU, I have occasionally been involved in cases on the ACLU's side of things, but not representing the ACLU per se. But mostly what I've been doing in constitutional law has been sort of reading, studying, and more recently commenting.
So you have a website which has a blog. Tell me how do we find your website, and how do we find that blog on constitutional law?
Well, if you go to the name of the firm, all spelled out, and of course I always have to spell Hoy for people. Sheila is from a good Irish family, and if you're proper Irish, it's Hockey. With a H in the middle there, but it's Snook and Hoy, SnookandHaughey.com. Or if you just plug my name into Google, it'll come up to the law firm. And then off to the side, there's a place where it says firm blogs, and one of the places is constitutional law, and that's where I've been putting my thoughts on the First Amendment issues that relate to this permitting issue.
And how long have you been doing the constitutional part of the blog?
Well, we've had the blog up for about probably 4 or 5 years. About the last 2 or 3 years, I haven't been saying much. I've been too busy practicing law. But there was a lot of stuff to talk about this time around. So about 2 weeks ago, I started writing a lot of articles. I had been putting them on my Facebook page, and people would want to ask me more questions and want to relate back to it. And frankly, I could never find it on my own Facebook page. So
right.
I figured if I put it on my law firm website, at least I could find it again.
There's been a lot of talk in the news this last week or so about the problems of the alt-right group getting insurance and permits. What can you tell us about that from a constitutional perspective?
Well, the first thing to recognize is that the city doesn't really have the constitutional authority to place limits on somebody's speech. And in fact, what folks often don't understand is that the city actually has an affirmative obligation to enable speech in public forums, fora, if you want to be correct about it. The public forum doctrine is the doctrine that says that if a government establishes a place that is the kind of place where people speak freely, that the government cannot limit the ability of people in such a place to speak freely. Some of the places that constitute a public forum, one obvious one is a park. Going back to Hyde Park in London, you know, the long tradition of if people want to go give a speech someplace, they get on a soapbox and they stand up in a park and they preach to whoever comes by. So public parks have always been deemed to be a public forum. And so we have an absolute right to speak in a public forum. The catch is that at some point the government has to decide who has a right at any particular time so that you don't have contradictory, conflicting uses of the park. If 15 different people all descended on Emancipation Park all at the same time and they all wanted to speak at the same time, obviously nobody would end up getting heard. And so what the city has done is, as most jurisdictions have, they have a process where if you want to reserve a particular place, if you want to reserve Emancipation Park so that you have the right to kick out everybody else who comes, you can do so. You have to do so with a permit, and there are certain procedures that can go along with that. But the permit procedures and the costs of the permit can't be excessive. So, for example, the city couldn't say to somebody, we'll let you reserve the park there, but you've got to give us a $5,000 deposit. That would be too much. And most of the decisions that have been based on this kind of thing actually have their roots in the old civil rights movement. If you go back into the 1960s, for example, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to do his marches in places like Birmingham, Birmingham insisted on a permit that would involve insurance and deposits and all kinds of costs. And they complained that these costs were chilling their free speech rights. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. So in 1963, for example, when Birmingham was the scene of those, and we've probably seen the horrible film of the dogs and the fire hoses being used against kids who were marching in May of 1963. That was a march that was done without a permit because the permit was too expensive. And ultimately, that case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court many years later. And in a case called Shuttlesworth, Fred Shuttlesworth was the lead plaintiff. He was from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Shuttlesworth versus City of Birmingham, the Supreme Court said, you can't restrict speech, you can't chill speech by imposing these costs on the speakers. And so as a result of Shuttlesworth and the other cases that have been decided since that time, the power of the city to really require much from the folks applying for the permit is pretty limited. I mean, we can ask for a processing fee, you know, $35 or something like that, but you can't force somebody to put up front the costs of, for example, police protection. The police protection is the cost of the city, and it's always going to be a cost of the city. And the city has the burden of making sure that what happens happens without violence. One thing I want to point out that people, I think, don't really understand, when the city police were ringing Justice Park and keeping, you know, standing as the line between the crowd and the KKK, the city has an absolute duty to preserve everybody's safety and to allow the KKK to speak. The city doesn't have the right to say, okay, Klan, you can speak. Yes, we know it's dangerous. Yes, we know there are people who are mad at you and want to come stop you from doing it. Whatever, y'all have at it. Can't do that. The city has to be able, and does in fact, come in and say, we're going to keep the parties separated. And that's by law. That's by the Constitution. There was a case from the 1990s, for example, involving Forsyth County, Georgia. Forsyth County, Georgia was known as a place that was just viciously white. And there was a black civil rights march through there, and the police had to get involved and keep everybody separate. Went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue, and yes, in fact, the local jurisdictions do have to do that.
We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back with Lloyd Snook to talk more about the constitutional implications of the alt-right movement, and in particular with their visit to Charlottesville. You're listening to WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Sean McCord. We'll be right back. We're back with Lloyd Snook of the firm Snook & Hoy, and we're talking about constitutional issues as they impinge and reflect upon the alt-right meeting, which is coming up in next weekend.
Could I just finish one thought before we broke?
Yeah, please.
There are some people who look at what happened on July 8th as the establishment protecting the Klan, as the police and the city government protecting the Klan and enabling their hate speech. And in a sense, in a very superficial sense, that's true. They are enabling the hate speech. But it is really important that everybody understand that it's not a matter of choice for the city. And so if you, as some people did on July 8th, they wanted to go get in the face of the police officers who were standing there protecting the Klan, that was what they were required to do. Not just they individually, but what the city was required to do.
So I just want to be clear on this, because I've been hearing people talk about, you know, saying, well, why doesn't the city just not issue the permit? And I think you've covered that clearly. Let me reiterate so that we make sure I understand at least. The city has, they can issue, they have the right to issue permits, but they do not have the right to refuse a permit.
Well,
is that correct?
Not that's close to correct, but let's be clear. The only thing that having a permit does is that it gives the permit holder the right to say, I've got the exclusive use of this space, I can run other people off. It also, depending on the nature of the permit, it may give them the right to use amplified sound, or if they have asked for street closures, they may be able to get a street closure. But if Jason Kessler and his buddies just want to come assemble at noon in the middle of Emancipation Park on August 12th, nobody can stop them. If 500 people all want to come, nobody can stop them. So one of the things that the permitting process does is that it forces them to come talk to the city at least a little bit about what they're planning to do, how they're planning to do it, and maybe the city would be able to have some ability to say to them, you know, can we do it this way? Can we, you know, let's talk about what streets we're going to need to close. Let's talk about, are you going to have porta potties, for example? There's no requirement in any statute, any constitution, or any other place that you have a porta potty. But if you're going to have 500 people there for a few hours, you probably want to have a porta potty. So there are a few things like that that having the permit gives, and the permitting process, it gives the city at least some influence on how this thing's going to go down.
There were several news stories this last week about the issue of insurance that the alt-right group could not or had insurance and was canceled. I'm not really sure if I understand the details, but it sounds like they came out of it without having insurance. Are they constitutionally required to have insurance?
And in fact, there is substantial authority that suggests that the city doesn't have the constitutional power to require insurance. That very narrow issue has never really been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, but there have been enough other cases that say essentially the same thing, so I think that's pretty clear. It's a cost. Even though Kessler says he was able to get his policy for $66 or something like that online, it's not a huge cost, but it's just one more cost that I think the courts would probably say is not really necessary or appropriate under the Constitution. But specifically, just to talk a little bit about the history, what happened with this, Kessler, as I understand it, decided that he would go ahead and get this policy anyway because people were fussing about it. The city's policy, there's a standard operating policy that the city has for what they call special events. Special events under the policy come in two categories. One is, for community events. Special events is one category, and demonstration is another category. And they define them differently, and they have different requirements that apply to each of them. So, for example, if you're going to have a food festival in Emancipation Park, as they do at least once a year, that's an event because it's not specifically a First Amendment political speech kind of a thing. That's an event where they will insist on certain things like insurance policies and that kind of stuff. But the policy, the standard operating policy that the city has says no insurance, no required security for a demonstration.
So what's the concern with these news stories that we've heard in the last?
Okay, so
days?
Kessler went ahead and got this policy, and if you look at the policy binder that was given, there were a number of things on there that were just kind of nuts. For example, the insured party, him, but the other, again, the additional named insured, as I recall, they called it, was Lee Park. Lee Park has never existed as an entity.
Right.
Obviously, it's a part of, it was under that name, a part of the city of Charlottesville. But they weren't purporting to comply with the policy that would have said that the city of Charlottesville should be a considered beneficiary of the policy. Apparently, there were some misrepresentations made in the application. Somebody with knowledge of the insurance business called up the company that had written the policy to say, do you realize what it is you've just been insuring? And they said, my goodness, no. And they can't, and they canceled the policy based on what they were claiming were misrepresentations made to them in the application process. All of that was really sort of a sideshow because it really didn't matter legally.
Right, right. Joining us in studio now to join the conversation is David Von Strom. David is an active, let me get, see if I get this right, David. You're an active member of the local Black Lives Matter group?
That is correct. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Sorry for my lateness. always busy, especially in this time.
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm not Sean.
It's quite all right. No. Don't apologize for that. I'm just happy to have a forum to speak out on this issue. But yes, thank you for having me.
So David, what's your, well, it's pretty probably an obvious sounding question, but what's your interest in the upcoming alt-right movement?
Well, I think interest is bad choice of words, maybe. But I do have a stake in it, and that being that this is not just any ordinary rally. This is not just any ordinary congregation of souls coming together for a common cause. These are people that have been addressing on social media their intention to intimidate and harm people of Charlottesville, predominantly people of color and predominantly activists and organizers of anti-racist and anti-fascist organizations. And it's all because of these Confederate monuments that Charlottesville refuses to remove. And even after being voted in favor of removing the statues, they choose to not. These are magnets and beacons of hate that that attract white supremacists to congregate together under the guise of free speech to threaten, frighten, and intimidate, and even harm people of color. This Tiki Torch rally that Richard Spencer held in May is an example of that, and it was just started to emulate the intimidation tactics of the Ku Klux Klan, who also served as an anti-civil rights task force in the South during the 50s and 60s. This increased attention to Charlottesville is the direct result of the city's decision to retain the monuments. More violent, racist, and fascist organizations will come into this town until these statues are removed. These monuments are Confederate participation trophies. They deify generals who believed in American treason, slavery, and the continued subjugation of black people and people of color. And whereas a museum would be a perfect place for these monuments, as museums show artifacts of how cultures used to believe and not presently believe in these days, the city has refused to do so. And if they haven't refused outright, they're dragging their feet. And this leads to a continued invitation to hate and racism and racist organizations in our community. And until these things are removed, it's going to continue.
Let's be clear about one thing. The city cannot remove the statues right now. There's a court order that says that we can't remove the statues. So when he says that the city chooses to not remove them, what the city is choosing to do is to obey the court order.
And what's the substance of that order, of that court order?
The substance of the order, when the injunction was brought, was sought, and the lawsuit was brought by the folks who want to keep the statues there, they asked Judge Moore of the City Circuit Court for an injunction to basically say, don't let anybody change anything until you make your decision, Judge. And so this is fairly standard that you enter into an injunction to preserve the status quo. And that's what all that has happened is the judge has said, until I figure this thing out, nobody moves anything. Because obviously if you move it and then he makes a decision, oh, you shouldn't move it, then you've got to move them back or, so preserve the status quo. I have to say, in all honesty, it was a 6-month injunction. And the judge sort of gave himself a timeline at that point where I think the 6 months may be up in October or November. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it is. And then, of course, I'm sure there will be an appeal and I'm sure there will be an injunction continuing thereafter. But until the thing is figured out in the courts, the city has basically no legal choice. And I hope we're not in a situation where we're telling everybody that the city ought to defy the court order. The city needs to abide by the court order, needs to challenge the court order, needs to try to move to get the injunction dissolved, as they have. But we shouldn't be defying the court order.
But, well, if I may, with all due respect, when you say preserve the status quo, that's exactly what Charlottesville has been doing for the past 100 years in supporting racism, in supporting the Klan. On how UVA and the Klan have been in cahoots, so to speak, and how the Klan has pledged thousands of dollars to the University of Virginia in that time, how Charlottesville supports Confederate statues, Confederate values, traditional, fundamental, white Christo-fascist beliefs.
So let me ask, is your response that the city should intentionally violate the court order?
No, I don't.
So the city shouldn't move the statues right now. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the city has a moral obligation to show the community that they are doing exactly what the community asked them to do, which is remove the statues, or actually act in a way that is progressive in doing so, and not just standing still to a court order and not saying, "Oh, well, we'll just revisit the issue in 6 months." I think we should push the envelope. I think we should try.
How? Yeah. What does pushing the envelope mean in terms of when there's a court order that says you can't move the statues? What does pushing the envelope mean to you?
I think it means confronting our elected officials, confronting those judges and those people who allowed this court order to go in action, adding pressure. Not in any ways of physicality by any means, but just in a sense of legality. I mean, everybody can like step away and look at this and see that this is a problem, and this problem is going to increase until we do something about it. And I think an intellectualization of this discussion is dangerous, and it continues to leave our city in the state that it's in. If we continue to intellectualize it and rationalize it, and say that we just can't do anything about it because we're outside of our legal authority, then that leads to stagnation in the process of removal. So as long as we keep pushing, keep banging that drum, we'll be able to get these statues out of here as soon as possible. But I don't think that we, just because there's a court order, that we should just sit on our hands and be like, "Oh, well, we'll just wait until the courts figure it out." We as a community, we need to move forward, and we need to add pressure to these elected officials to make sure that they do their job and make sure that they protect the people of their community, because this is a reason why these people are here.
Lloyd, I'd like to come back to you again for a minute. On your blog, you say it's hard to regulate demonstrations. What do you mean by that?
Well, the Supreme Court and the federal courts have basically said that almost any restrictions that are placed on speech, as to the content of the speech, basically anything that's a content-related restriction, to say, for example, we're going to regulate the speech of white supremacist activists, but we're not going to regulate the speech of, Black Lives Matter. That is absolutely 100% wrong, unconstitutional, invalid, can't do it. And that has its roots, of course. As I said, it really got clarified for us all during the 1960s with the black-led civil rights protests, where the court, federal courts, and particularly in Alabama, were confronting the efforts by places like Birmingham and Selma to shut down any protest to the white establishment, and so that's where all of the content-based, the notion that you can't regulate content really got solidified at that point. So that much is clear. Now, the issue is time, place, and manner. That's what the Supreme Court has said you can regulate. Time, for example, you could say we're not going to allow this demonstration to happen at midnight because it would disturb people and time and so on. Place, is the issue that comes up in this particular instance. And the proposal has been made that maybe we should make the black, make the alt-right folks go have their demonstration in McIntyre Park or some other place. Some other place other than Emancipation Park. Of course, their answer, the alt-right's answer is, well, why bother to have a demonstration about the statue in Emancipation Park if you're not going to be in Emancipation Park? What's the point in having a demonstration in McIntyre Park to talk about the statue at Emancipation Park? So they would argue that the location of where they're doing it is an important part of their message. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, yes, that can be the case. It can be the case that where you are doing it is an important part of your message. So place, and that's not to say it can't be regulated. For example, excuse me, if you have a situation where you're going to be bringing 10,000 people, and you know that the park can only handle 500 or something, the city could properly say that's not an appropriate place for a demonstration of what you're talking about. But again, it doesn't have anything to do with the content. It only has to do with how many people you're talking about. It can also be a place regulation. Another thing that can't be considered is what the response of non-participants would be. This is the so-called heckler's veto problem, that if I'm standing up to give a speech and I know it's going to provoke an angry response, that I can be prevented from giving my speech because of the angry response that other people will have. And this, probably the dominant case for this was the case in the late 1970s of Skokie, Illinois, where the Nazi Party wanted to march through Skokie, which was, at the time, it was the city in the United States that had the highest concentration of Holocaust survivors or relatives of Holocaust victims. And the Supreme Court said, if the Nazis want to march there, that's fine. You've got to protect them. You can't deny them their right to speak simply because other people are going to be mad about it. And so the whole heckler's veto problem means that it's up to local government to make sure that things stay safe and don't get out of whack. And so you got hundreds of police officers mobilized to protect 40 Klansmen last month. And arguably, I mean, I don't know if there's really any legitimate fear that the 1,000 or so people around them were in any danger from the 40 Klansmen, but arguably to separate the two sides. So the heckler's veto problem becomes a real problem under First Amendment law, so as to make it very difficult for the city. The city can regulate time, place, and manner of the speech, but only without chilling that speech, only without turning off the sort of turning off the microphone, so to speak.
We need to take a break. We'll be back in just a very short while. You're listening to the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville at 94.7. This is WPVC. We'll be back to talk more with Lloyd Snook and David Vaughn about the upcoming alt-right rally, and in particular about the police response and what we might come to expect. We'll be right back. We're back with Lloyd Snook and David Vaughn, strong about talking about the alt-right rally. I want to go back a little bit to the Klan rally and the police actions there that made headlines. And I want to get each feedback from each of you about this. David, I assume you and your group are going to be on the front lines.
Absolutely.
This coming weekend. What's your take on how the police should handle this?
So I just want to go back to J8 and how the police responded. Lloyd mentioned a phrase called regulated content and how speech can be restricted. The content was only regulated after the Klan left the Justice Park on July 8th. And the community members who were still there, who had every right to be there because the park was still open until 6 p.m. The streets were blocked off until 6. They had every right to show as much disdain as possible and to exercise their First Amendment rights. And they were met with tear gas and riot gear and unnecessary arrests and emotional trauma. And I think that's interesting because we honestly did give the Klan the right to speak. We spoke louder, but we gave the Klan every opportunity to come and do their thing and leave. And after they left, we were met with violence and intimidation by the Virginia State Police and by the Charlottesville Police Department. So our demands of the day on August 12th, since we will be there, is asking the police to do their job. The police should protect, defend, and serve the interests of the members of the Charlottesville community and not the people coming into it to do harm to Charlottesville, despite First Amendment rights or whatever, and its people. They rolled out the red carpet for the Ku Klux Klan. They escorted them in. They escorted them out. They provided blockade so that their vehicles can leave. And then they proceeded to arrest and hurt and tear gas community members after the Klan left. And the responsibility of the Charlottesville Police Department is to protect the community members of Charlottesville, not to protect the members of people coming in and out, saying whatever they want to.
David, were you there for the Klan?
I was.
And were you there during the tear gas part of the...
I was.
Tell us what happened. Tell us how it went down.
Okay. So in the span of maybe 10 to 15 minutes after the Klan left, soldiers came out. They aligned along High Street, and as we stood and as we showed our disdain, they decided to fire off three tear gas canisters within 5 minutes. One of them going off right beside an older woman, probably in her 40s or 50s, and also a person of color. Another tear gas canister struck an activist member in the foot. She was badly burned and injured by that. Basically, the people that were fed with an emotional response and an inclination to show their First Amendment rights by opposing this threat, because the Klan has always been a threat to our community of people of color, were met with the same threat of violence and intimidation by the police department, who were sworn to serve and protect that community. And I think that's interesting. I would say to Lloyd.
So David, some of the news reports said that the crowd was unruly and they were throwing things at the Klan, but what I heard from other people who were there that wasn't true.
That's absolutely false. And I would invite the Charlottesville Police Department, of all of the cameras and all of the Facebook Live and all the social media live feeds going on, to find 1 second of footage that shows a community member throwing something at a police member or being unruly or anything of that nature. We have not seen that from the Charlottesville Police Department yet. All we've heard is hearsay and testimony that, oh, they were unruly, and oh, they threw things, and oh, they spit at us. Well, you know, if you say somebody hurt a person that you love, and then that person came back into your house, how would you feel? How would your emotional response be? And how would you be expected to react in a situation like that? And that's what happened. We had violent descendants of violent members who have hurt our ancestors come back into our community and pose the same threat that they always have had since the beginning. So that's how we feel. We have a right to express our outrage as Americans, as they have a right to show up and speak as Americans. That's the beauty of this country. That's the beauty of democracy. The right to dissent.
David, I know you have to leave us in just a minute. Any final thoughts or advice for your community with regard to the rally coming up?
Absolutely. And again, I just want to thank Lloyd and you, Dan, for giving me this opportunity to speak. I invite all members of the community to be the blueprint for the fight against white supremacy in this nation, because this is not the only place that these people are going to visit. They also visited Tennessee, and we're outnumbering community members 300 to 150 who spoke in dissent. So we have a chance to present a model to American cities and communities, perhaps even globally, since Canada is the recipient of over 100 white nationalist groups who are active in domestic terroristic activities, to to show a positive way to fight white supremacy and to fight racism and to fight fascism that comes into the community and show these violent racist groups that they are not welcome. And other cities can emulate this model and organize themselves to protect their own communities. If we can do it, they can do it. If Charlottesville can mobilize, then any city can mobilize. And we can be the blueprint. We can be the model to show how to combat this legally and as Americans, democratically. They have a First Amendment right to speak. And I have a First Amendment right to be outraged. Charlottesville, practice your American rights. Do you hate racism? Do you hate racism? Then say so. Since they've weaponized free speech and rights to invade and intimidate people of color in the communities, use your First Amendment right to show your outrage. You have an American right to be outraged. You have a right to be angry. You have a right to dissent. You have a right to speak out. Seville has a right to come together and contest values that are contrary to these inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what these people try to obstruct for people of color. They're not coming to have a soiree. They're not coming to have a potluck. They're coming with batons and helmets and weapons, and they're coming to hurt people. And we can stand and pontificate about First Amendment rights and, you know, talk about this until the cows come home, but come August 12th, we're really going to see what this group is about. And I hope that you're absolutely right. I hope they're just coming to talk and leave. But I really believe that that's not the case.
David, thank you for joining us. David Von Strawn is an active member of the Black Lives Matter organization here in Charlottesville. Thank you for taking the time to stop by and talk to us about this.
Thank you for your time.
So, Lloyd, anything you want to comment on what David said before we move on?
Yeah, I'm here obviously not as a Black Lives Matter person, but as sort of a lawyer, First Amendment person. I can sort of focus up my time on that. When David talked about how outraged he and others were that the police, as he said, rolled out the red carpet for the KKK folks on July 8th, the city, as I said, the city spent a lot of time trying to figure out how everybody was going to be kept safe and how everybody was going to, in this case, how the KKK members were going to come in and get out without riots ensuing, without whatever difficulty. I mean, obviously, they didn't know exactly who was going to be angry at whom and who was going to be fighting and who was going to be a difficult problem. I think it is a rhetorical device, but not really accurate to say that the city rolled out the red carpet escorting them in and out. Yes, they did, but it was purely in an effort to accomplish what they're required to do, which is to make sure that everybody stays safe. Their plan was to bring all the Klansmen in one place, get them all out in one place, get them out of town as quickly as possible. The catch for the alt-right people, and I think this is something I pointed out before, and David, I actually commented on as well, the alt-right people's method of operation is to sow chaos. It is not to have simply an orderly presentation of views. And so whatever else you may have seen from the Klan, you can certainly expect a different character of a different tenor coming from the alt-right folks than what came out of the whole Klan thing. Now, to me, I was at the rally on July 8th. I left before everything really got hot because, frankly, the Klan came. They marched around for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I didn't see anything happening. And it was, you know, anyway, I left, and I missed all of the stuff at the end. I will tell you that I also watched about 10 hours of video, and I saw at least one instance in a video of somebody spitting on a police officer. It did happen at least one time. But that I mentioned that not to say, and I also say I've been very critical of the police in a number of respects in how they handled things on July 8th and their free use of the "we're declaring this an unlawful assembly" when it didn't meet the statutory definition of an unlawful assembly. It was utterly unnecessary. And I've said that a number of different times. So I'm not here to praise the police presence and to praise the police response. I'm particularly not here to praise what I would call the militarization of the police, where when the riot squad is there and they're clearly there to be intimidating, I thought it would have been a whole lot more effective once the Klan left, just to, if the police officers had said to the assembled multitudes, okay, guys, the Klan's gone. You got an hour.
Right.
And just leave it at that.
Exactly.
They weren't hurting anything. Let them mill around. Let them do whatever they want to do for an hour. But at that point, it was about 4:45 till 6 o'clock was the designated time for streets to be closed. That would have been a perfectly easy way to solve the problem, it seems to me. And there really was no aggressive anti-police stuff going on. There were some people, individuals who were, you know, on video getting up in the face of the officers and yelling things at them. But, you know, police officers, I don't mean to be dismissive of their emotional state in all of this. I'm sure it was not pleasant, but they're trained to put up with that kind of nonsense, and that should not be, and I'm sure was not, specifically the provocation. Whether there was something in particular they were reacting to when they threw the tear gas, I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I know what they say.
But more to the point, the permit was still in effect when the tear gas was thrown. Is that right? You said it was
of course, I think that the permit to the Klan was actually 3 to 4.
Okay.
But the overall city plan for dealing with it was that they were expecting streets to be clogged and closed until about 6.
Is there any constitutional implication to the police action at events like this? I mean, we do have the right for peaceful assembly. That's spelled out for it. Spelled out in the Constitution.
Yeah, the Virginia statute on peaceful assemblies or unlawful assemblies is kind of vague, kind of poorly written, and it leaves some confusion in some ways. Ultimately, an assembly isn't really unlawful, even though the police officer may stand up and say, we've declared this to be an unlawful assembly. It's not really unlawful until a judge 2 months, 3 months later says, yes, I think the statutory requirements were fulfilled. The real problem, I will tell you, is if you are at a place that gets declared to be an unlawful assembly and you happen to have a firearm on you, it's not just a misdemeanor, it's a felony. And so if there's anybody out there who's thinking that they're going to go down to this rally on August 12th armed with a concealed weapon, even though you may have a lawful permit to carry the concealed weapon, don't. Because whereas everybody else in the crowd may be facing a misdemeanor and maybe a little jail time and maybe a fine, you might be facing a felony with significant prison sentence, significant fine. And it's, I guess, if nothing else, it ought to be an incentive to everybody to leave your weapons home, come down, peacefully protest one on the one side or the other, but let's make sure it stays peaceful.
What's your take, Lloyd, on what's going to happen police-wise this coming weekend?
Well, the real question is, what lessons did the police learn from last time? If the lesson that they think that they learned is that getting having the massive presence was important to maintain order, my own personal take on it was that at least as far as dealing with the Black Lives Matter people and the other folks on the what I'll call the left side of the equation, that was, if anything, an irritant. If anything, it provoked more of a response, and that I didn't see any indication that it was truly necessary. Yeah, I'm not a police officer. I don't make those decisions, but I've seen a lot of rallies and I've seen a lot of demonstrations and going back into the 60s and 70s. And there's a way to handle those that kind of de-escalates and defuses things. But the important thing that I've been trying to talk to some of my friends who are in the group who will be protesting the alt-right to say, let's try to make sure that the police officers have a sense that it's the alt-right guys they need to be worried about. It shouldn't be us that they're worried about. It should be they are protecting us from the alt-right people, not that we are a danger either to the alt-right people or to the police. And that's an attitude that we on our side of this equation need to kind of inculcate in ourselves. And I hope that the police will come to understand on August 12th who their friends are.
Lloyd, thanks so much for joining us. The hour has gone by so quickly. There's so much to talk about. Any final thoughts? You've given some great advice about carrying weapons during the protest. Don't do it. Any other advice for people who might want to go down there besides maybe stay away?
Well, you know, there's talk. Who knows whether there's going to be a mobilized, organized civil disobedience effort of some sort. Just have an idea of why you're there. If the reason why you're there is to be a witness against the hate of the alt-right, don't duplicate that hate yourself.
Let's have that URL one more time for your law firm.
www.snookandhoy.com, or just Google Lloyd Snook and it'll come up in the first couple links, and then you can go, and I'll have some more things to say about constitutional law in the next few days.
Lloyd, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you here. We hope you'll come see us again real soon. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Dan Gould sitting in for Sean McCord, who was at the last minute taken away. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be back next week with more of the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.